But I'd like to begin with two quick stories. I'd like to tell you about something everybody either has right now or has had in the past, and that is a mother. Our mothers are amazing creatures. They are absolutely amazing. I want to tell you two quick stories about my mother. My mother is an amazing woman, was, as I was a little child, someone that I was in awe of. She was an amazing lady. She was a Girl Scout leader. She was a Cub Scout leader. She was a cook. She was a laundress. She was a gardener. Everything she seemed to do, she did well, and everybody loved her. The most important thing about her is that she was so pleasant most of the time. When she wasn't, it was probably my fault. Well, actually, it's probably Steve's fault, or John's, or Skip's, or Deb's. Probably not mine, but she had five children. One of the things I wanted to tell you about is that there were a lot of years in there that we just didn't have a lot, like a lot of families. You get by with what you got. And one of the things that was really cheap were navy beans. How many know what navy beans are? See, I asked that question in Youngstown, and two people raised their hand. How can you not know what navy beans are? They're the worst tasting thing ever grown by man. Like, well, how can you even have a navy bean? Navy is like on the water, out in the ocean. What is it? These beans grow in the ocean? I don't even know where they come from. But to cook them by themselves, it's like ghastly. Like, what? How could you feed these to people? This has to be animal food. Okay, have you all had like bean soup? See, my mother was really adept at make, as she would call it, we got to make things stretch this week. You know what that meant? We got nothing to eat, and it's not going to taste very good, but you got to eat it anyway, you're going to starve to death. So she would, this was before we went to church, take this ham bone, throw it in the beans, boil it for a couple hours, and call it soup. But she was brilliant because she knew we hated, at least me. I think I can confidently speak for all my brothers and my sister. We did not like bean soup because it had no taste, primarily. And then the beans were kind of, they're like a lima bean. Would you kind of consider them like a lima bean, but not quite a lima bean? They're just, like, who would eat these? So we cooked this soup, but we knew when we came home that we were going to have something like bean soup because there was dessert. Now, you all grew up, or a lot of us grew up, in an era that you didn't have dessert every night. Now, how many of you now have dessert a lot? Okay, just me. All right. I mean, dessert was a very special thing. You only had it every once in a while. See, we weren't Sabbath keepers yet, so we didn't have, like, Friday evening. We have a nice family meal and a nice dessert to top off and welcome to Sabbath and all those things. So she would make the best dessert ever was chocolate pudding. And those were in the days you didn't have instant pudding. There was no such thing. You didn't buy it in a cup and take the lid off and then eat it. You actually had to cook this stuff. And you somehow put milk and chocolate stuff in this thing, and you cooked it for a while, and then she would pour it in these little dishes. And then it would sit in there, and then it would form this skin on top. How many remember the skin on top? Yeah, isn't that the greatest stuff? That skin, my wife and I tease about that, would turn my wife's stomach. She would scrape the skin off and give it to her brother. Ew, it's just skin. It's like eating skin. Who wants to do it? So she's got some texture issues when it comes to food. But you pour milk on top of that skin, and it's like a little ocean there, and it made eating bean soup kind of tolerable. So she was a brilliant lady and still is. She doesn't make bean soup anymore, thankfully. At least not when we visit, so we're okay. Second thing I remember about my mother is that when it was time for bed, she would make this strange squeal, and we all knew it was time to run. And we would run up the stairs. We lived in a big old farmhouse. Run up the stairs, and she would pinch our little bottoms all the way up, making these strangest of noises. It never really occurred to me that that was a wonderful memory until my little daughter was 4 years old. And I'm squealing and chasing her up the stairs and pinching her little bottom all the way. I think, why am I doing that? Because it was so much fun. That's what my mother did. Moms are wonderful people. Now the question is, who is the mother of Israel? Trivia question. We all, hopefully, have wonderful memories of our mother, or either if she's still with us, still do. If not, maybe past memories. If you don't, I'm sorry. Sorry you didn't have that kind of relationship that would provide wonderful, pleasant memories of your mother. But the Bible actually talks of someone as the mother of Israel. And we're going to take a look at the mother of Israel and her life to see what we can learn about it and apply in our situations. And this does not apply just to mothers, just to women. The lessons of her life can apply to all of us because they are timeless lessons of character and wisdom that I think you'll enjoy as we go through it. Who was the mother of Israel? Well, the answer is found in the book of Judges. Maybe you already thought of this. We're not talking about a spiritual thing in the sense of an analogy. This woman actually called herself the mother of Israel. Now, she did so poetically, in a poem, in a song. But nonetheless, Deborah, in Judges chapter 5 and verse 7, refers to herself as the mother of Israel. Now, the King James and the New King James says a mother to, or a mother of Israel, or a mother in Israel. Other translations just as easily render that the mother to Israel. And you'll see in the context that's certainly what was the case. She became a mother figure for the entirety of the tribes. Deborah, Judges chapter 5 and verse 7. What we'll do here, we'll come back to this a little bit later, but we'll draw out of this song, this poem that she wrote, in the chapter 5, just for that phrase. We'll come back to the poem in context a little bit later. Judges chapter 5 and verse 7. The King James says it this way: the inhabitants of the villages ceased. They ceased in Israel. Now, does that mean everything was empty? No. It means they were going through a very hard time. It's like nothing was happening in the villages of Israel. Something was drastically wrong. They ceased in all Israel, it says, until that I, Deborah, arose. That I arose a mother in Israel. And as I mentioned, other translations render this a mother to Israel. So all these cities are languishing. Something is holding everything down. It's as if nothing is happening until she rises and mothers Israel. Mothers provide an outstanding service to humankind. Deborah provided an outstanding service as a mother to Israel. What can we learn from this larger-than-life woman, this mother to Israel? Let's take a look at a few things. Turn back a page in Judges chapter 4. The first thing I believe we can learn from Deborah's life is that we have to use our insight to serve others. Now, you could use the word insight. You can use the word wisdom. You can use the word intelligence. Any one of those certainly would be the case. Deborah was an outstanding woman because she used her insight to serve. Now let's take a look at that. Judges chapter 4, in verse 4. Deborah here is recorded as the fourth judge of Israel. Now we'll pause for a moment just to give you a brief reminder about the period of the judges. There were no kings in Israel at this point. You had most of the tribes living on one side of the Jordan River. You had 2.5 tribes living on the other side of the Jordan River. And they were a loose association of tribal groups, primarily families grown large. And as this nation of Israel, or this confederation, probably is a more accurate descriptor at this point in history, at this point in time, as they obeyed God, things went fine. And then they disobeyed God and fell off over the course of time and turned to idolatry. And as they turned to idolatry, God punished them. He allowed them to be oppressed or occupied or taken over, we might say, by foreign tribes. And they would oppress them. They would steal their crops and require tribute and things like that. And after a while, the Israelites would cry out to God for mercy and in repentance, and God would give them a leader. Now, to me, that's fascinating. People repent, God gives them a leader. It's an interesting thing. It applies in a lot of ways we won't take the time to look at now. So, when Israel was provided a leader, that judge or that leader would not only judge for Israel, showing them righteousness and unrighteousness, good and bad, fair and unfair. The judge would lead them oftentimes in military victory, throw off the oppressors, and as long as that judge was alive, people would do well. The nation would do well. The tribes would do well. After that judge passed from the scene or died, what would happen? Drop off. Eventually into idolatry, spiritual adultery. And then oppression would come. They'd cry out to God in repentance. God would provide them a leader. And then they would throw off that oppression. Deborah is number four in line of the judges. Now, we don't normally think of a woman in that position when we think of ancient Israel. But Deborah was a larger-than-life mother to Israel. Judges chapter 4 in verse 4. And Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, she judged Israel at that time. Judges 4 in verse 4. Says several things about Deborah. First of all, it says she was a prophetess, a Nebiyah. That's the feminine version of a prophet, a female prophet, a prophetess. Literally, the word might be rendered an inspired woman. She was inspired. She had insight. She had wisdom. She had the ability to deal with others. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Now, interestingly enough, by implication, this word is sometimes used to imply a poet. Society needs poets. The church needs poets. You might say, well, poet, they're kind of spacey, weird people. Yes, they are. But they have insights that the rest of us don't usually have. Songwriters have insights the rest of us don't usually have. They're able to put into words feelings and thoughts and emotions that the rest of us don't know quite how to say. So when you and your wife or your husband were courting, didn't you have your song? Because it could express what Deborah was able to express, these kinds of things. That's why we read a portion of a song that she wrote in chapter 5. To help commemorate what had gone on in her service as mother to Israel. So here she is, this poet, this prophetess, this wife. We're not told specifically that she had children of her own. She may have, she may not have. The scriptures are unclear as far as I understand in that regard. Maybe that's why she was so able to mother Israel, because she didn't have that personal responsibility for her own children. That may be the case. But what's important is that her insight was based upon an outstanding relationship with God. So if we are to serve others with insight, with wisdom, with accuracy, it needs to be based upon our relationship with God. And that's something we can really learn from Deborah's circumstance. She had a solid relationship with God, a great connection with God. She was able to use the insight that she had then to serve others. Now, maybe I'm reading more into this than I should, but my sister is named Deborah. So I knew from the time that I was a little boy that the word Deborah means bee. It means like buzzing bee. And that was what Deborah's name meant. And I can't help but wonder if she didn't serve in that way. She saw a need here. She went over here. I had a chance to sit about 2 weeks ago under a cherry tree. I was looking to kill something, turkey, but that's beside the point. Sitting under this cherry tree for about 2 hours. And just, it was filled with blossoms and filled with bees. And each bee would go, I'm paying attention to the bees and not the turkeys, I guess. But they're going from one flower to the next. Whatever needed to be done, however they could serve, in essence, it kind of struck me that Deborah's name is that way. And here are these bees performing this function. What a wonderful insight that she would probably serve here. How did she get this reputation? How did she get to be a mother in Israel? Somebody would say, hey, there's Mother Israel. No. She was serving. She was giving constantly. She would go here, take care of this need, then stop over here, take care of this one, and over here, and take care of that one. She was an active person looking to serve others. This reputation developed, and now Israel would come to her for wisdom, for insight. Let's look at verse 5. She dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah. It's like there's a location. You know, we would say, oh, they live down in Canton. There's a location. Oh, she serves down at the palm tree of Deborah. Oh, well, of course. That's her location. People would actually come to her for wisdom. She dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in Mount Ephraim. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. They recognize wisdom, God's wisdom in this woman. And therefore, she would use that God-given talent to provide judgments or verdicts. Now, it's not particularly clear at this time in history in Israel if judges were similar or quite a parallel to what we would consider as judges today. Today, in our jurisprudence system, we have a judge. When the judge makes a decision, it's final. Everybody does what the judge says. If they don't, they go to jail, or there are some other consequences as a result. Judging in the time of Israel was much more, let's work these things out, as opposed to, here's the sentence, here's the decision. So I picture Deborah, the bee, more of the kind of situation as the elders in the gate used to be. When there was a decision that had to be made, the elders sat in the public area by the gate, and they would discuss the situation, they would come to a conclusion, and they would follow through with it. Deborah seems much more that kind of judge, and judges were at that time. Let's sit down, let's work this out. Okay, you say he stole your sheep. You say you didn't steal his sheep. Now, Joshua, how many sheep do you have? You got 100 sheep? Okay, how many sheep do you have? You got 98? I mean, can we trade one? Both have 99. Can we work this out? Can you spare one sheep? Yeah, I think I can do it. So what we see is here's a woman who's able to work relationships. And it's interesting that when we talk about when do you need a judge, you need a judge when you cannot resolve the relationship issue. It's not stuff. These things are not about stuff. They're about relationships. When you settle the relationship, the stuff takes care of itself. So when there is a problem in the church, among members, is it a problem about stuff? Or is it a problem about relationships? Well, they didn't put out my snack last week when I brought it. Okay, is that a snack problem? Or is that a relationship problem? So, not that it's happened, by the way. I hope I didn't step on anybody's toes there. But the point is, Deborah was able to use that relationship with God, parlay that into working with people to resolve these issues. I mean, if someone says, look, I signed a contract and you're supposed to provide this, and I look at it, you didn't provide it. Do I need to go to a judge for that? You just didn't do what you said you're going to do. What do you have to solve? You have to solve the relationship. The contract is clear. What did Mr. Armstrong say so many years ago? Humans' problems are spiritual in nature. Not about stuff. We can deal with stuff. We can deal with things. It's always relationships. Who tend to be the most successful people? Those that work with relationships. Can solve, bring these parties together. That's an exceptional talent that Deborah seemed to have had. Israel would come to her for a decision. What is exactly right? Brethren, when something is black and white, do we need a judge? No, we don't. If it's obvious, okay, do I steal this or do I not? Well, it's pretty obvious. What does the commandment say? Don't steal it. Where do we have the need of an arbiter or a judge? When you got all those gray areas and many, many issues in life are in those, what's exactly the best thing here? You know, I remember I'm talking with a person any number of years ago. He said, look, I'm a business owner. I need to talk to you about tithing. I said, well, yeah, let's sit down and talk. Now, the principle of tithing is very clear, is it not? 10% of your increase is God's. That's pretty simple. Is it that simple? Okay, if I'm a wage earner, yeah, it's pretty simple. This is the amount I get. Divide by 10, that's God's. That's what I do. That's what you do. This person was a business owner. And he said, look, if I go by the tax laws, I, every year, have no income. So how does that work? Well, I buy a new truck, and I write off $20,000 on the business. Now, I have taken out that $20,000 to spend during that year, but because I bought a truck, the business shows no increase. Therefore, the business has made no money. Therefore, I don't owe a tithe. But I'm not comfortable with that. Are you comfortable with that? I said, no. I mean, the gospel needs to be preached, and I like to eat. Thank you. So is that right? No, that's not right. So how do I handle this? I mean, I could literally have zero income year after year after year, or very little income compared to what I actually spend. So he began, we talked about it back and forth, and how do you deal with that? And finally he realized, well, okay, well, I just have to tithe on what I take out of the business. That makes much more sense. Because one year the business might have $50,000 in the account, next year might have $150,000 in the account, and next year might have $2,000 in the account. That's the business account. I said, well, can at the end of the year, can you tithe on what's in the business account? And so the business is part of what you are and who you are and what you're doing. Oh, yeah, that's a great idea. So some of those things can easily be worked out, but they're a little gray. Well, what exactly? How do I handle this? That's the kind of thing that Deborah probably was an expert in. People would come to say, we're in a conundrum here. We can't figure this out. What's the best way to handle it? What do you think God would want in regard to this decision or that decision? So all Israel would come to her. Now Deborah was not what some have termed a mother with an S in front. And that is a smother. Mother, get off my back. She was not that kind of mother to Israel. Now, sometimes we would say things like, mother, get off my back, when that's exactly where mother needs to be, riding you because you need it. That's, we all need that from time to time. At the same time, here, Deborah was not downing Israel, not criticizing Israelites. Can't figure this out for yourself? What's wrong with you people? She was able to discern. Let's go on to point number two. Second thing we can learn from Deborah, besides using insight to serve, which all of us can be doing, number two, don't go it alone. Don't go it alone. The reason I word this point this way, a lot of ways we could say this, no man or woman is an island. Include other people, lots of ways we could say this. But the reason I phrase it this way, don't go it alone, is for our ladies. Because you live in a culture today that is encouraging you to be tough, to be on your own. You can do it all. You can go to college, while you're going to college, get married, have two children, work three jobs, and still be fine and have time for your martial arts class that night. You can do it all. The answer is no, you can't. You cannot. Something will suffer. There are only 24 hours in a day, and for most of us that means 16 or 18 hours awake a day. You will not be able to do it all. Face the facts. No man can do it all. It's interesting that Deborah understood that she could provide the service that she was. She could provide the opportunity to give wisdom, to give insight, to give judgments, to give verdicts, to give help, to bring parties together. But what was the judge's role in almost every other case, every other judge's case? It was also to be the commander-in-chief, the general of the army. She realized that was not her place. And one of the reasons I bring that up, Pam and I recently did a class at Foundation Institute on masculinity and femininity. And what is fascinating is that most action heroes in the movies today are women. Fascinating. It is fascinating. You type action hero into Google and you'll get lots of women and a couple guys. It's just interesting to see how that. So we've got this image in our culture that's constantly being portrayed as you have to be tough. You have to be able to beat the snot out of a man, and then somehow you're a powerful woman. Like, where did this come from? Now, well, is that a true value or what? Yeah, I want to snuggle up to that woman that could break my neck if she wanted to. Oh, yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. Notice what we read here in Judges 4 and verse 6. She sent and called Barak. Barak, I suppose, if you'd like to pronounce it that way. But Barak, probably the emphasis is on the first syllable. Barak is not a particularly popular name for some people, I guess. But she called Barak, the son of Abinoam, out of Kedesh Naphtali and said to him, hath not the eternal God of Israel commanded, saying, in other words, what she's saying, I've got a message from God, Barak, and I want you to understand what God is telling you to do. Go and draw toward Mount Tabor. Take with you 10,000 men of the children of Naphtali and of the children of Zebulun. God is telling you to be the commander-in-chief, the general of this army. God has said now is the time to throw off the oppression of our enemies and be independent once again. Verse 7, he tells, or she tells him what God has said. God says, I will draw unto you to the river Kishon Sisera, the captains of Jabin's army with his chariots and his multitude. I will deliver him into your hand. So God is telling Barak that he will be the chief, the commander-in-chief, the general, who will lead the army. Deborah understood it was not her place to do so. She understood that Eve, when she was created, was said to be a help, fitting for her husband. Now, that's not to say we don't have extremely competent women who can do all kinds of wonderful things. But those women that I've known, oftentimes, who think they can go it alone, who want to be tough and strong, also are unhappy. Because they haven't found that understanding that God has created me to be a help in whatever I'm doing. That doesn't mean we can't lead. Deborah was clearly a leader, but she understood that she was a help. And that there was a place that she shouldn't be. She shouldn't be at the head of the army. It was inappropriate. It was just not to be done. It wasn't right. She saw the need to include others. Doesn't say she went to God and said, what? Have you seen this Barak guy? This Barak? I mean, you know what he's like? He's kind of a chicken liver. Not a man to stand up around here, frankly. That's why I got to do this job. It wasn't her approach. Many times in our culture, women are tempted to believe that they can go it alone, that they can do it all themselves, and don't need anybody. That is one of our consistent cultural messages. It's just wrong. It's just absolutely wrong. We are designed to be interdependent. And a woman who can do the be, the Deborah, serve here, help here, do this, and that's leadership of and by itself. It's a wonderful opportunity to help and serve others. Don't go it alone. Don't think you should have to go it alone or can go it alone. Sadly, our culture sometimes puts requirements on our women to be on their own, by themselves, sometimes because of others' faults. But don't fall for that. But that's the norm. That's the standard. That's what God wants, because He certainly doesn't. He does want strong women. There's no question about that. Proverbs 31 is very clear. Strength and honor are her clothing. We know that. But that doesn't mean we set aside the very purpose for which women were created, to be a help, a service. Again, having an outstanding wife certainly reminds me all the time what a great blessing that is to have such a great help. So let's go from there. Don't go it alone. Don't think you can go it alone. Don't think you should go it alone. Make that community a part of what you do, and we draw people together. Women are those who can draw us all together. Men don't do that. Women are really good at that. I don't usually sit down and think, you know, we ought to have somebody over for dinner. It should come to my head, but it rarely does. Or I say, you know, somebody's really, you're so discouraged. We'd have them over. Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, good point. Let's do that. Of course, she has to do all the work, so I would be a fool to say, hey, let's have 20 people over this weekend. Nonetheless, let's go on to a third. A third issue that I think we can draw from Deborah's life is we need to learn to preserve one another's dignity. We need to learn to preserve one another's dignity. What do I mean by that? Deborah probably could have had every right to make fun of Barak. She could have belittled him. Here's what he says. Judges 4 and verses 8 and 9. And Barak said to her, you know, she says, you got to get these 10,000 men together and go down to the river and take on Sisera. And Barak said to her, if you go with me, then I'll go. But if you will not go with me, then I'll not go. Now, maybe I'm reading more into Barak or Barak than I should, but he sounds like a little bit of a chicken liver. Well, Mom, if you go with me, then I'll go. But if you're not coming, I'm not going out there. Now, maybe he recognized that she was a woman of God, that she was a prophetess, and he wanted her along. Maybe we're reading more into this than we should. But certainly she could have said, what is wrong with you? I mean, God gave me this message. He said, you're the one to do this. What do you mean I need to come along? Where's your strength? Come on. Where's your power? Where's your manliness? Come on. She didn't do that. Didn't belittle him. What she said is, okay, I'll go. Now maybe he was just afraid and felt that if God's judge, the prophetess, the mother of Israel was there, the one that everybody recognized, it would be everybody's comfort and strength. Maybe that's what he was thinking. But she didn't point out whatever it was, whatever his lack might have been. She simply said, I'll go. Now, verse 9, of course, she says, I will surely go with you, notwithstanding the journey that you take shall not be for your honor, for the Lord shall sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. And Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kedesh. So, because of his, and this is why we can presume it may have been fear, it may have certainly been at least a lack of faith, God said, this is not going to be for your glory. Someone else is going to put the nail in the coffin, as we might say, almost literally in this case, as you remember the story. Hold your finger here or put a card in. We always ask everyone to stick a 3x5 at the front of their Bible so we can jump back and forth a little bit more easily. Stick a finger there or your card in Judges 4 and turn with me to Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 1. Proverbs 14 and verse 1. I think this is something that Deborah must have understood because she did such an outstanding job in the nation of Israel of bringing this to pass. God used her very powerfully to unify Israel at this time under her leadership and, of course, Barak's as well. Proverbs 14 and verse 1, it says, the wise woman builds her house. She's very careful, just as we all might be or want to be, to build our homes. He goes on to say, but the foolish tears it down with her own hands, is the way the New American Standard says it. King James says it plucks it down. It doesn't give quite the picture as the foolish tears it down with her own hands. Now I would submit to you, obviously, this is being poetic. Woman, literally, I've known very few who literally have destroyed things in their houses, throwing them at other people. Most women don't go around kicking out windows and smashing doors and ripping up couches and chairs and things like that. How does one usually tear down her home? It's with her tongue. It's with her tongue. So Deborah had this skill of being able to build Israel by not her hands, but by the use of her tongue, using her words wisely. So when we say strength and honor are her clothing, she used words honorably to help others, to preserve their dignity. When people came to her for judgment, somehow, as they left, they were all pretty much satisfied. You know how we know that? Because people kept coming back. Others kept coming. Her reputation was such that somehow she's able to work this out. We wanted to strangle each other before we got there. We left shaking hands and hugging and walking out doing well. Isn't that the kind of people we want to be, brethren? When people have issues, we bring them together, we work through the issues, and they go home basically happy. We start with that in our own homes. A wise woman builds her house. She does that primarily with her words. And then, of course, her actions follow that. The foolish tear it down with her own hands. And again, basically all the own hands means is that it's personal responsibility. If there's a happy household, what's the old saying? Mama's happy, everybody's happy. If mama's not happy, nobody's happy. Now, we're not saying that the same isn't true of men, because that often can be the case. But in this case, she was able to deal with Barak and his lack of courage, or at least lack of faith, and still uphold him. She could have upbraided him before everybody and made fun of him, ridiculed him for his lack, for his weakness, for his shortcoming. But she didn't. She simply said, yes, I'll go. Now, that would have been very encouraging for Barak. Now, maybe years later, he said, I don't know why I was so lacking in faith. I shouldn't have been. But I really appreciate Deborah coming along. It gave me the strength and the courage that I needed. What was she doing? She was helping. She was a help. yeah, I'll go. I'll be with you. So in this case, we want to, as families in the Church of God then, how can we apply that? How can we build our house? I believe, first and foremost, the wise woman builds her house by encouraging her husband, by respecting and honoring her husband. That's the first and primary way. Lots of other ways after that. But the house is simply a word for the household, the family. So we want to build that family unit. And our wives play such a huge role in that. And again, that's not to diminish the role that husbands and fathers play as well. But we'll focus on this since we're talking about Deborah today. Let's go back to the book of 1 Samuel, if you wouldn't mind. 1 Samuel chapter 25. It's another example here of a wise woman who understood this issue of dignity, or we might use the word respect. We've touched on this before in various venues or other ways, the importance of respect, of a husband feeling respected. We'll see that played out here as well. I think we've mentioned to you before, an author by the name of Shante Feldhahn did a survey of men and asked, to try to understand what men are like, asked, would you rather feel unloved, and I'm paraphrasing, or would you rather feel disrespected? And a huge majority, it was like 70, 80, 90% of the men, said, I would much rather feel unloved than feel disrespected. It's interesting. Huge majority. Now, that translates, okay, if I want my man to feel loved, he has to feel respected. She asked the same question of women. What do you think the answer was? Would you rather feel unloved or disrespected? What do you think the vast majority of women said? Oh, it'd be much worse to be unloved than respected. Much worse. I would much rather feel loved, not worry about the respect. I could take the disrespect, that's no big deal, but I want to be loved. I want to feel loved. That's interesting. Not everybody answered that way, but the majority did. And you might say, I don't even understand the question. That's fine. But the point is, Deborah somehow understood that even though you had to deal with issues along the way, preserving dignity is the right thing to do. Certainly Abigail understood that. Here in 1 Samuel 25 is the story of Abigail, Nabal, and their relationship with David. 1 Samuel 25. Now Abigail, you might know, her name means great joy. Now, my personal supposition is that this was an arranged marriage, because the word Nabal, the person she was married to, so you have great joy married to Nabal. Nabal means fool. Now, I doubt that any little girl named Joy said, I can't wait to marry fool. I mean, wow, he's such a fool. Now, again, I don't know if parents just had a really, you know, bad labor and named this boy Fool, or if that became his name over the course of time, because that's what he was. We're not told. Nonetheless, he was a fool, and she was a woman of great joy and certainly great insight, much like Deborah. 1 Samuel 25 and verse 2. This is why I say it was an arranged marriage. Sweetheart, we've got your wedding arrangement set. Oh, Daddy, who's the man? Who do I get to marry? And he said, well, he's got lots of sheep. He's a rich guy, got lots of sheep. Well, great, great. Who is it? He lives in a really nice place. Oh, Dad, that's great. I can't wait. Who is he? Oh, he's got nice tents. Boy, he's got stuff. I mean, he's got servants, sheep, goats. Who is it? Who is it? It's Fool. Guarantee it was an arranged marriage. There was a man in Maon whose possessions were in Carmel. The man was very great. He had 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. This is a rich man. Now the name of the man was Nabal, Fool. And the name of the wife was Great Joy, Abigail. She was a woman of good understanding. One of the things she seemed to understand was her husband's need for honor and respect. She seemed to understand that. She could have easily upbraided him at any time for his foolishness. But it says she was a woman of good understanding and a beautiful countenance. But the man was churlish and evil in his doings, and he was of the house of Caleb. And that was what was so strange. He came from such a strong, righteous lineage, and he was a fool. How'd that happen? It just happens sometimes. So we have this situation. You remember the story. David and his soldiers are in the area. They protect Nabal's flocks and herds and their herdsmen for an entire year, basically. And they're making sure that the enemies, the oppressors, are not coming in, stealing sheep, killing servants, hauling things away. David's soldiers are protecting all this. Never ask for a thing. Then finally at the end, David sends a few servants to Nabal and says, could you give us a few things to eat? It would really help us. And Nabal does nothing but insult these men and thereby insults David and says, who is this desert rat? I don't know this kid. It's David. Who's he? David was so angry at that. He lost his temper. And he had one solution for Nabal. I am going to go kill every male that has anything associated with this guy. Every servant, every son, every child that's a male is going to die. I will not be disrespected like this. Abigail understood things very differently. She realized what a fool Nabal was. Verse 14, one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to salute our master, and he railed on them. But the men were very good to us. They were not hurt, or we were not hurt. Neither missed we anything, as long as we were conversant with them. And we were in the fields. They were a wall unto us by day and night, all the while we were with the keeping of the sheep. Now therefore, know and consider what you will do, for evil is determined against our master and against all his household. For he is such a son of Belial that a man cannot speak to him. What an idiot. What a fool. So now he's going to lose his life and all his children are going to die with him. At least all his male sons. What did Abigail do? She was a woman of understanding. She could have gone straight to her husband and nailed him to the wall for this idiocy. What do you think you're doing? Do you realize who you've insulted? God has anointed this man future king and you've insulted him? What an idiot! How could you be so... I mean, she could have said lots of things. But she didn't. How did she deal with that? She never once criticized him in front of others. Even though he could have deserved it easily. Verse 18, Abigail made haste, took 200 loaves, 2 bottles of wine, 5 sheep ready dressed, 5 measures of parched corn, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, laid them on asses. She said unto her servants, go before me, behold, I'll come after you. But she told not her husband Nabal. We're hearing one person comment as well. See, she was a rebellious wife. Wrong. Absolutely wrong. It was a life and death matter. She was saving her husband's skin. She was a help to him and to all that was his at this point. In spite of his foolishness, in spite of his idiocy, she simply said, we've got to act and we've got to act now or we are all dead. Now, there are few circumstances in life that are this immediate, this threatening, where a wife is simply going to say, I got to do this, I don't care what he thinks, I got to... It's not life and death. In most cases, okay, he made a bad decision, he spent money he shouldn't have spent. That's not life and death. It's just money. We can work through those things. In this case, she was saving their lives. So you remember the story. Sends the stuff, meets David in the way, and then begins to build the house. Build her house with her words. And she simply said to David, you don't want to do this. Now, we don't know the exact words. I mean, we got the abbreviated story here. But the bottom line was saying that if you go and do this, David's name is going to be associated with murder of Israelites. You really don't want that. Nabal is a fool. I mean, that's his name. We all understand that. But you don't want this on your character. You don't want murder of Israelites associated with your name. Let God take care of this if there's something that needs to be taken care of. And David said, wow, what a woman of insight. What good understanding. Now, she could have upbraided David. She could have said, who do you think you are? Just because somebody insults you, you're going to come and kill their entire family? What's wrong with you? Where do you get off thinking you can do this? You think you're God or something? Couldn't she have said those things? Could she have been accurate about that? Yes. He was being a fool, just like Nabal was being a fool. So she could have said those things, but she understood the need to preserve another's dignity. When correction has to be given, if dignity can be preserved, there's a much greater likelihood of the person accepting that correction as their own, seeing the value in it, and changing. Much greater possibility. Much greater percentage. She understood that. So she presented in such a way, is this how you want to be known? Someone insults David and he kills their entire family. She could have said a lot of things, but preserved his dignity. In this case, David came to see that she was absolutely right. Absolutely right. And so he says, you've saved me from making, in essence, a grave mistake that would have been irreversible. You can't change after you do something like that. So if we can learn, brethren, when we need to correct anyone or any situation, that if we can have in our minds the need to preserve the other's dignity, treat them kindly, work with them as a mother, father, sister, or brother, to work through the situation, we will be much better off, and they will as well. Deborah was able to do that. And that's, again, why time after time Israel would come to her for judgments. Because they knew that she loved them, that she would work for the benefit of everybody involved. Most of all, she would strive to maintain what was right. Let's go on to a fourth thing we can learn from Deborah. Fourth thing, use your power to encourage others. Use your power to encourage others. You all have power. In some situations, you have a lot of power. In some situations, you may have less power. But whatever power you have, use it to encourage others. That's what Deborah did for Barak. Judges chapter 4. Go back to Judges chapter 4. We'll pick it up in verse 10. Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kedesh. So he went through with it. He knew Deborah would be there. He called the armies together. He went up with his 10,000 men at his feet. And Deborah went up with him. What do you think the effect of Israel was upon these Israelites, the Naphtalites and the Zebulonites, when they saw Deborah standing there on the hill next to their general? It must have been so encouraging, so powerful. Wow, there's the mother of Israel. There's Deborah. Fearless. I mean, how many women go out and stand on the battlefield? You know, in those days, not very many. It's a pretty impressive feat. Now, she had great faith in God, trusted that God would do exactly as he said he would. Verse 11. Now, Heber the Kenite, which was of the children of Oholiab, the father-in-law of Moses, had severed himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent under the plain of Zaanim, which is by Kedesh. And they showed Sisera that Barak the son of Abinoam was gone up to Mount Tabor. So the spies did their work and found out where he was, where they were camped, and they set up the battle. Verse 13, Sisera gathered together all his chariots, even 900 chariots of iron, and all the people that were with him from Harosheth in the Gentiles under the river Kishon. So the battle is set. Now we should paint at least a little bit of the picture here. 900 chariots of iron was a massive force for the day. They could have easily taken this force of 10,000 men. It's interesting that when we understand the dynamics of battle and understand the difference between horse-drawn chariots and the soldiers in them and a foot soldier, the foot soldier stands virtually no chance. Virtually no chance. Horses were trained, first of all, to trample whatever was in front of them. So most of these individuals fighting against chariots would never get near the person driving the chariot. And the speeds at which they were able to come simply could not be... something as simple as a horseman. Some of you might enjoy history. Comanches in the West in the late 1700s could fire 20 arrows from horseback in the time that one Spanish soldier could load his blunderbuss and shoot it. Now, this is awesome. The Spaniards have never seen horsemanship like this, and they come to the Comanches and find out that we don't stand a chance. So a small band of 3,000 Comanches could route 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 Spanish army without much trouble. So the Spaniards pulled back from New Mexico and northern Texas and even southern Texas for a long time because they just couldn't deal with this. And these Comanches learned how to ride horses in such a way that as they're riding past the line of fire, they would sloop off the horse onto the side of the horse, and no one could shoot them because they weren't there. They're just hanging all they saw was a foot and a hand on the mane. Now, how do you do that? Many people, historians now say the Comanches had the same kind of horsemanship that the Mongols did, and allowed the Mongols to do what they did in the Far East many, 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 many years before that. Nonetheless, let's go on from there. This is a powerful army. You don't win against 900 chariots of iron, whether you're 10,000 men or not. So this could have been a very intimidating situation. Deborah stood strong in faithfulness to God. Barak did as well, and that was extremely encouraging. When you stand strong in the face of trial or difficulty, in the face of attack, that's very encouraging to your brothers and sisters in Christ. Verse 14, Deborah said to Barak, "Up, for this is a day in which the Lord has delivered Sisera into your hand. Is not the Eternal gone out before you?" God's already decided the battle. So Barak went down from Mount Tabor and 10,000 men after him. So she was the one literally that said, "Now is the time to attack. God will take care of you." That's very encouraging, very inspiring. When you go to your brother or sister who's suffering and say, "I don't know what it's going to be like, but I know God will help you. I know God will take care of you. He will make sure this situation works the way it should. He will not forsake you. There'll be hard times, but God will be there. All will work together for good. We may not understand it now, but it will be right in the end." It's very encouraging. So she used her power to comfort, to encourage. I'll have you jot down 2 Corinthians 1, verses 3 and 4. 2 Corinthians 1, verses 3 and 4 says this, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies." And then he's called this, "the God of all comfort." Encouragement is comfort. That's what it means to give courage and encourage. It says, "God, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God." Some have told me over the years, "Well, you know, I was really sick and nobody called me." And I can only apologize. "Well, I'm sorry." What do? You remember. You never forget that. And you make sure nobody else goes through that the way you went through it. Make sure you call then. Use it for a positive purpose to encourage others. Deborah seemed to be able to use these situations to really empower others and strengthen them. So when we understand God gives us comfort, for what? So we feel better? No. It does make us feel better, but that's not why he does it. He gives us comfort so that we will pass that comfort on to others, that we'll help them in the same way. We're in a family. We're in this together. Let's go on to point number 5. Two other quick points and we'll finish. A fifth thing we can learn from Deborah is that we can inspire others to achieve their potential. We can. God often works through you, through people, through us. And we can be an inspiration to others to achieve their potential, to do what they need to do, to stand strong when they need to stand strong, to stand strong in the face of opposition, to stand strong in the face of trial, to stand strong in the face of doctrinal problems. We can inspire each other to achieve the potential that God has for us. Notice here in Judges 4, pick it up in verse 15. "The Eternal discomforted Sisera and all his chariots and all his hosts with the edge of the sword before Barak, so that Sisera lighted down off his chariot and fled away on his feet." In other words, he got out of the chariot and ran away scared, spitless. He was running for his life. Now, what's not told here, doesn't come out till later on in one of the Psalms, probably the song that Deborah wrote. How did 900 chariots get defeated by 10,000 relatively untrained individuals? Well, God caused an extremely heavy rain. And the river flooded the plain where the battle was set. So you take an iron chariot on hardtack and it goes like crazy. You take an iron chariot and put it in a foot of mud and what happens? It doesn't move. So God simply flooded the plain, turned it to mud, and the chariots were absolutely useless. How much chance does 900 have against 10,000? No chance at all. They wiped them out, every last one of them. Wow. I think, it's my opinion, that Deborah inspired Barak to achieve his potential as a leader in Israel. Verse 16. Barak pursued after the chariots and after the host unto Harosheth of the Gentiles. And all the hosts of Sisera fell upon the edge of the sword, and there was not a man left. Howbeit Sisera fled away on his feet to the tent of Jael. Jael, probably pronounced Jael. His wife, the wife of Heber the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. So in other words, he thought he was going to a safe place. One of their allies, or at least one that they were not at war with. A Kenite's tent. And Jael, verse 18, went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn in, my lord, to me, fear not." And when he had turned in unto her, into the tent, she covered him with a mantle. He thought he was going to be safe there, hidden there. And he said to her, "Give me, I pray you, a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." And she opened a bottle of milk and gave him drink and covered him. Now, personally, I think that was intentional. What is milk compared to water? Milk is a natural relaxer. There's something about milk. Maybe you had this when you were a small child. Couldn't sleep or something was up. What would mother do? Take a little warm milk, put it in a pan. That's before microwaves. That's how old I am. Before microwaves. Wow, what's that? Isn't it hard to remember what life was like before microwaves? You actually had to heat Saturday evening dinner up after the Sabbath. Like you had to wait to eat. Now you take leftovers, bah, 60 seconds, you're eating. Oh yeah, baby. But mother would take a little pan, pour some milk in it, heat it up, have you drink some warm milk. It's a natural sedative. If you have trouble sleeping, you might try that sometime. So she gave him milk. Maybe she understood that same thing, that it's kind of a sedative. It'll knock him out. I mean, he's been fighting, he's been running, he's been terrified. He went into a deep, sound sleep. Again, he said to her, "Stand in the door of the tent. It shall be when any man does come and inquire of you and says, 'Is there any man here?' then you'll say, 'No.'" And Jael, Heber's wife, took a nail of the tent. This is a tent spike. This is not a sixpenny finishing nail. I mean, this is a spike that holds down the tent. Nail of the tent, and took a hammer. And when you think hammer, this is, again, not a 16-ounce hammer. This is a mallet that this woman yielded. Took a mallet in her hand and went softly unto him and smote the nail into his temples and fastened it to the ground, for he was fast asleep and weary. Now, she would have done this apparently through the carpet that he was lying under, the blanket, but you could pretty easily see where his head was. Just nailed it right through his head. This is a strong woman. Now, my personal opinion is that probably Deborah was encouraging to her. Just by her example, she may have never met her, but to understand that you can help build the nation, build Israel. In this case, it's clear who our next ally is going to be. It's not going to be Hazor. It's going to be down in Ephraim. That's where we need to be loyal to. She understood that. Verse 22, "Behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, 'Come, I'll show you the man whom you seek.' And when he came into her tent, behold, Sisera lay dead and the nail was in his temples." That first swing must have been a powerful one. This was no small woman, no doubt. We can inspire one another to our potential as we encourage each other. As we set a right example, people see that And they want to emulate those things. Christians should be those that others desire to follow. They want to be like that. They want to be kind. They want to be thoughtful. They want to be helpful. They know in their heart of hearts that that's the right thing. So we can assume that all Israel was inspired by the courage and the example of Deborah. Let's go on to one final point. Give the credit to God. What can we learn from Deborah? To give the credit to God. After Sisera was dead, Israel prospered because they'd repented. They'd been inspired by Deborah. She taught them righteous moral principles. Did Deborah ever take the credit herself? No, she always gave it to God. Judges 5, verses 1 through 12. Here's the song, or at least parts of it. The poem that the poet wrote. Deborah apparently wrote this herself. Then sang Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, on that day, saying. So she wrote the song. Whether she sang it directly, that seems to be the indication. Praise you, the Lord, for the avenging of Israel, when the people willingly offered themselves. What was the key? The people had repented, therefore God would lead them. God would direct them. He would spare them. He would help them. Verse 3, hear you, kings. Give ear, O princes. I will sing unto the Eternal. I will sing praise to the Eternal God of Israel. Eternal, when you went out of Seir, when you marched out of the fields, out onto the field of Edom, the earth trembled. The heavens dropped. The clouds also dropped water. That flood we talked about. The mountains melted before the Lord, even Sinai from before the Eternal God of Israel. In the days of Shamgar, the son of Anath, in the days of Yael, the highways were unoccupied by the travelers, and they walked through the byways. In other words, there was so much oppression on the main highways, they couldn't travel them. They had to sneak around the back roads. But, verse 7, the inhabitants of the villages ceased. They ceased in Israel. In other words, you couldn't trade. You couldn't send goods back and forth. They'd be taken by the oppressors. So you went the back roads as best you could. Everything ceased. Until I, middle of verse 7, I, Deborah, arose, that I arose mother to Israel. And she didn't smother them, but she mothered them. Mothers remind us what is right. And I think sometimes more so than fathers. Mothers have a way of saying, oh, sweetheart, you know you shouldn't be doing that. She was a mother to Israel. They chose new gods. Then was war in the gates. Was there a shield or a spear seen among 40,000 in Israel? My heart is toward the governors of Israel that offered themselves willingly among the people. What was she saying? The leadership turned to God and did what was right. Good thing. Her example helped inspire that. But she shared the credit. She did not take the credit for herself. Bless the Lord. Verse 10. Speak you that ride on white asses or donkeys, that sit in judgment, walk by the way. They that are delivered from the noise of archers in the places of drawing water. There shall they rehearse the righteous acts of the Eternal. Even the righteous acts toward the inhabitants of His villages in Israel. Then all the people of the Eternal shall go down to the gates. Awake, awake, Deborah. Awake, awake, utter a song. Arise, Barak, and lead the captivity captive, you son of Abinoam. So what an inspiring song. It would have been interesting to hear how it would be sung and how it would have been danced to. Deborah was an outstanding woman of character. Teaches lessons that we can all benefit from. Let's close by looking at Proverbs 31 in verse 30. We're all familiar with the Proverbs 31 woman. It's helpful to see how it concludes. Because in this we see a picture, I think, of a woman like Deborah. A woman of character that can teach us all some important lessons. Proverbs chapter 31 in verse 30. Closing this discussion of the Proverbs 31 woman gives a summary. Favor is deceitful. Other translations render that charm. Is deceitful. Charm is deceitful, New American Standard says, and beauty is vain, in other words, useless, temporary, fleeting. But a woman who fears the Eternal, she shall be praised. What does our culture usually want of women? Charm and beauty. What is least important? Charm and beauty. A woman who fears the Eternal, she shall be praised. Like Mary choosing the wise thing, the spiritual thing, this woman did as well. So, brethren, we've learned a quick story about the mother of Israel, Deborah. Let's do what we can as we go about our time of fellowshipping, our time of serving one another. Do the best we can to learn the lessons from the life of the mother of Israel.